Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge, and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule, it's just whenever I finish a book, I do the review, stick it up here on the podcast feed for everyone to download and listen to. And today, I'm going to be reviewing the book called The Year of the Flood by Margaret Atwood. Now, the reason I'm reviewing this book now is because it's the second book in the Mad Adam trilogy, and I read the first book a few years ago, maybe three or four years ago, and I remembered liking it quite a bit, I guess, and but I never got round to the second book in the series. I couldn't remember why. And then the first book in the series, Oryx and Crake, was a book club book by a podcast that I listened to called the Geek Knights Podcast, and they read it and reviewed it and talked about it there, and I was like, yes, that's what I remember. Oh yeah, that's also what I remember. And then one of the hosts of that podcast, Rim, he continued on with the series and finished the series and was talking about it recently on the podcast and said, actually, the second book is probably better than the first book. So I was like, ah, okay, I'll get round to this soon, and have done so. And so that's why I listened to it again. Now, as I was listening to the audiobook of the Year of the Flood, I was thinking, ah, I have a few issues with this, and it starts a bit slow. But I wonder what I rated the first book when I reviewed it here on the SFBRP. And so I went over to my website, sfbrp.com, and there's a link that you can click, and it takes you to episode lists, it's called. And the episode lists all of the podcasts, and it shows the, you know, the episode number and the book and the author and also the star rating that I gave the book. And first of all, I didn't see it, and then I realized, all right, there it is down at the bottom. And I didn't actually read this book for the SFBRP and review it here on this podcast. I was a guest on the SFF audio podcast with Scott and Jenny, and we talked about it, the three of us talked about it there. It's one of Jenny's favourite books, or this series is one of Jenny's favourite series, and she really enjoyed it, so she had some notes there. And Scott was a bit middling on it, but I couldn't remember exactly what I'd given it, and I realised I'd given it 3 stars. And it's one of those kind of times where I go, ah, I remember enjoying this book, the first book in this series, a lot more. So when I'd finished The Year of the Flood, I thought, well, I better go back and listen to the podcast that I recorded about the first book, because I remember enjoying it a lot. I remember there's some really good writing and things, but it's like, what didn't I like about that first book? So just today, I listened back to SFF Audio Podcast episode number 233, where me and Scott and Jenny talk about Oryx and Crake, and I explain what I didn't like about that first book to only give it 3 stars. And I had a lot of good things to say about it, but one of the main things that I didn't like about it actually wasn't so bad in the second book, so that's why I probably realized I enjoyed this second book more than the first. However, I definitely forgot how much I didn't like Oryx and Crake. So I guess that's a good thing. A book, like, as time passes, I just remember the good stuff about the book. I don't remember the bad stuff about the book as time passes. And that's happened quite a few times, and when I'll go back and read another book, and I'll be like, oh, all of the complaints that I have about the book now, I then have them again and realize why I only gave it 3 stars last time. And I'm thinking, oh, it's probably about a 4-star book. No, it's a 2.5-star book. So getting into this book, let me bring up the Wikipedia page here. I have it open already. The Year of the Flood, 2009. And it says the book focuses on a group called God's Gardeners, a small community of survivors of the same biological catastrophe depicted in Atwood's earlier novel, Oryx and Crake. The earlier novel contains several brief references to the group. The setup for the first book is exactly the same as the setup to this book. And the way it works is that there's a dystopian future. A few decades into our future, there's been like massive societal degradation and ecological degradation, and things aren't really looking good. You got the rich people who live in the kind of like the burb claves, if you want to think of them that way. Let's bring up the Wikipedia page again. Yeah, so there's the some people live in the has something here. The plebes live in the non in the plebe lands, and then you have these different compounds where corporations kind of have these gated compounds where the people who are employed with proper who have higher education and have money, and they have these different compounds like the Healthwiser compound. And the first book, Oryx and Krig, mostly takes part. Takes place in these different compounds, the Healthwiser compound, and then they go to these different universities, the Watson Crick University and the Martha Graham College, and the Healthwiser High, a high school attended by these different characters, and that's where the first book mostly takes place. This second book mostly there's some action takes place there, but a lot of it takes place in the plebe lands, in what's called the Sewage Lagoon, and it says here, a plebe area formerly known as Willow Acres. And so the first half of this book takes place there. And there's not really much story going on. However, it's very clear that this story is taking place at the same time, or in the same time frame, as all of the first book does. Because the first book is kind of told in a flashback of someone who has survived this catastrophic biological plague that has wiped out all of humanity, and he's then thinking back. This is Jimmy. He's thinking back to what his life was like beforehand and how they got into that situation. And we start this, of course, before the plague with the God's Gardeners, and they're talking about what's coming. They're talking, there's something coming. It's called the Waterless Flood, and this Waterless Flood is going to wipe out humanity, and only the animals are going to be left. And there's going to be some new Adams and new Eves, or new Noahs, and new whatever Noah's wife was called. And it's kind of in the run-up to this plague with this eco-cult, which is wanting to look after the environment and kind of nurse the environment through and try and remember them and try and save different animals and plants and, you know, pretty much be gardeners. And then when humanity is wiped out, the natural world still has a bit of a chance to regrow and bloom. So what we have in this first half of this book, like I say, is very little story. It is all set up. It is all like, okay, there's this character and she is doing this, and then there's this character and he is doing that. Well, I just mentioned some of these characters here. The two main characters that we follow are Ren, who is at the start of the book is kind of quite young, maybe like 10, 12 years old, and her mother kind of fell in love with one of these God's Gardeners, guy called Zeb, and ran away from the Healthwiser compound to live with these God's Gardeners, with this cult, and her mother is there, and so she lives with her mother and is there, and she makes some friends, and she's hanging out with other people, with other kids her age, and learning different bits and pieces. And so that's what happens throughout the first half of the book, is we just kind of follow what it's like to grow up with the God's Gardeners. There's lots of singing, there's lots of learning the different days of the year. Every single day of the year has a different saint associated with it. So this is Saint Crick, and this is Saint Diane Fossey Day, and the Day of the Animals, and this is Saint Francis of Assisi, and I'm like, oh, that's a real saint. But then they'll be like Saint Robert Burns of Mice, and I'm like, isn't that poet? He's not a saint. And as it goes through, you realize all these different saints. Some of them are real saints, but a lot of them are, you know, cultural people like Robert Burns, or scientists, or other political figures. There's Saint Mahatma Gandhi Day. Things happen there on that day. And that kind of stuff goes on. The other character that we follow is a character called Toby, and she is trying to get through life. She's kind of older than, quite a bit older than when it starts off, and she's already, you know, late teens, early 20s, and she is in a really bad place. She's working for secret burgers, and the idea is that there's not a lot of food around, so if you want a burger you can come and eat meat there, but you don't know what meat is it going to be rat, is it going to be dog meat, is it going to be pig meat, is it going to be human meat? There's always that big thing, and part of secret burgers appeal is that you might be eating human, and that's kind of like a human kind of thing. And she gets into some trouble with some different people and some bad people, and is kind of rescued from her stalker, from her previous boss by the God's Gardeners turning up and saying, "Hey, come on, come and help us out. You can live with us." And she kind of escapes a former life and becomes one of the Eves, because all of the different characters are the main God's Gardeners, the ones who've been there long enough. They have their Eve numbers and Adam numbers. So Adam 1 is there, and Zeb is Adam 17, and these other main characters are Adam 13 and Adam 9 and Eve 6 and Eve 9 and Eve 1. I actually don't think we ever meet Eve 1, but all these different characters. And over time, Toby becomes Eve 6, I think, replacing someone who leaves. And so the first half of the book is pretty much us just getting the story of these two main characters, our two viewpoint characters. But when I say the story, it's not the story. There's not really a lot going on. It's just a lot of world building and what it's like. And you do get some story of like, oh, they do this and they meet this and they learn that, but there's no moving the story of the God's Gardeners forward, except by maybe someone is off in the distance doing something over there, but we're not following what they're doing. And so While I was enjoying the writing and enjoying the characters of this first half of the book, it did feel very, very slow. Up until almost exactly halfway through, and I know that because the audiobook came in two parts, and within the last 20 minutes of the first half of the audiobook, what happens is that Jimmy turns up from the first book. Toby has to leave for different reasons, but also Ren has to leave for different reasons as well, and she goes back with her mother back to the Hellfizer compound because her mother decides she's had enough of Zeb, and she goes back and takes Ren with her, daughter with her, and then Ren, you know, meets up with different people in the, you know, in the compound, and then she realizes she goes to school, and she was like, and there was Jimmy, and I was like, ah, yes, Jimmy, now I know who's going on. And also they mention, oh, there's someone else, and Jimmy is hanging around with a guy called Glenn, and I was like, oh, Glenn is Craik in this first book. So what we have is, of course, and I was like, ah, right, now I know Jimmy, and Anakin's kind of suddenly see all the connections, and he realized that, you know, some of these people are going to be, like, at the end of the first book, Jimmy is around, and he suddenly sees, ah, some other humans survived in this post-apocalyptic thing. Some other humans survived and turn up right at the end of the book, and he's like, right, I'm going to go and meet them and find out who they are. So it was kind of quite clear at the beginning of this book that these are some of the people that Jimmy is going to meet, because there's lots of singing going on with the God's Gardeners, and they're kind of mentioned a bit that it seems like these are going to be some survivors, and of course they are at the end of this. So the second half of the book is really the story, more of the story of what's going on. We get a little bit more Jimmy, but we get a bit more Glenn, which is Craik from the first book. But the second half of the book is all like building up to this same biological plague, this disaster, and sort of like other questions. Okay, was it man-made, and who was spreading it, and what was going on? A lot of those questions are asked. There is, of course, people growing up even more and finding different jobs and doing different things and getting themselves through, and how they survived through. Well, actually, we find out right at the beginning of the book how these different people survived through into the post-apocalypse. But the stories kind of, you know, the flashback stories kind of catch up with each other, and the book ends with, of course, some of the characters from this book being in the same situation with Jimmy meeting other characters at the end of that book, and they kind of comes back and end the two books end at the same place, except of course at the end suddenly some other people turn up, and I was like, ah, that'll be probably the third book in the series is going to tell like who else is going to turn up. So in this one day at the end of Jimmy's story, that's also the one day at the end of this story, and probably is going to be the one day at the end of the next story as well. So I've already downloaded the third book in this series. So the only issues, well, I have some issues with this, is that in that first half of the book, it is so much, it's not as bad as the first book, but so much as of it seems to be really, really grim. Now, this is dystopian future, and it's, if things are really, really, really bad. One of the appeals of eating a secret burger is that you might be eating human, and that is kind of like a fun thing to be contemplating, like, oh, this might be human, may it not be human. This really ties in to what I didn't like about the first book, and that I'd kind of forgotten how much I didn't like about the first book. And I only realized when I listened back to the podcast that I recorded about that with Scott and Jenny, and I was saying one of my major complaints about that first book is that it was really, you know, it was really grim in places, and I didn't enjoy reading about somebody who was getting off on watching child pornography and wanted to have his current girlfriend be a victim of child abuse and kind of getting off on that. And so much of the book, or a lot of the book, was about these really nasty characters doing nasty things to each other or getting off on nasty things happening to other people. And it just wasn't pleasant to read about that. It was so degrading and so depraved that I just, you know, it was difficult for me to enjoy. And I'd forgotten all of that stuff, which is why when I was thinking back on that first book, I was like, oh yeah, you know, Oryx and Crake, surely that was a 4-star book. I remember really liking it, but I remember not liking so much about the main character, Jimmy, and other characters treating other people really, really badly. And I must admit, to a lesser extent, I have the same complaint about this book. Certainly in that first half and a bit in the second half, it seems to be, I mean, and the word that was in my head was kind of like, it was kind of pornography to read about the deprivation of the world and deprivation of the character. I can kind of understand why it can be thrilling to read about people being so despicable to each other, and that people can just, you know, rape and kill someone and just get away with it. And, you know, that's not the good part. They're not the good people in the book. They're not the heroes of the book. But just as it, you know, as the things go on, it's kind of like titillating to read about stuff so bad happening to these main characters. Thankfully, just dropped my phone on my laptop. Thankfully, in this book, it isn't the main characters themselves getting off on the bad things happening to other characters, but there is so much bad stuff that happens to the characters in this book that it can get it is meant to be, I guess, depressing. But so often in these books, you start off with these really depressing things that happen at the start of the book, and it's about people escaping that. But in this case, there's kind of characters who are starting to escape this, but then they're just like, oh, well, you know, actually what I should do is probably just go and become a sex worker, and that's the way out of this depravity. And, well, it's interesting that this is the world that needs to be destroyed, and the certainly more in this book, that it's, there's a lot more, you know, with the Adam and Eve's and the, you know, the Noah's Flood. There definitely needs to be a certain amount of depravity for the world to be destroyed, or all of humanity to be destroyed, and only the animals survive. It feels like, I don't really felt like I needed to spend quite as much time reading about people doing such bad things to each other. However, this book, like I say, it doesn't touch the heights of the first book in that case. And also, it's kind of a bit more understanding, because in that first book, it's people who are the upper class people who live in the compounds, who have a very easy life, who have a very comfortable life, and yet they are still putting each other through bad things and wanting to see bad things happen to other people. Whereas in this book, it's more like, oh, these are people living in the plebe lands. They live in an area called the sewage lagoon. They're going to have a hard life. And it kind of felt a little bit more, I wouldn't say forgivable, but a little bit more understandable that these characters are in these situations that aren't good for them, and are in these situations where bad things happen to them. It felt like, oh, okay, it kind of serves a bit more of a reason to be there, rather than just reading about depraved characters doing bad things to each other. What else do I have to say about this? Oh yeah, as I was talking about the audiobook before, let me bring up the audiobook. I really enjoyed the audiobook, and I'm going to say one of the main reasons why I enjoyed the audiobook. Where is it? Year of the Flood. Can I get the view book details here? So we have three main narrators here. We have Bernadette Dunn and Katie McNichol. I'm not sure which one of these, but one of them takes the chapters with Ren, and one of them takes the chapters with Toby. So you have kind of a younger voice in one of them, and a slightly older female voice for the other one, and a kind of they are sharing the main part of the narration. But then you've got this other character who is also not so much a viewpoint character, but Mark Bramhall is the narrator, and he narrates the words of Adam One, who is the cult leader, the self styled messiah who is of the god's gardeners. And what we have throughout the book is at the end of every two chapters, we have this third little bit. So there'll be a Toby chapter and a Ren chapter. And then we have a part of a speech by Adam One. And he says, okay, consider this passage in the Bible and how are we going to apply it to our part of, how are we going to apply it to our situation? You know, there's this kind of thing where it says, oh, the cunning of the snake. Oh, when in the Bible it says the cunning or the wisdom of a snake, what does that mean? And how do we apply that to our lives of being, you know, vegetarians who are looking after these plants and animals and making sure these things survive, and we're never going to eat meat. Oh, we know, because we're the God's gardeners and we're looking after it. And then they do a song, and Adam One always says, please join me in singing this song, and he sings a song. Now, I really, really enjoyed this, not because the music was good, but in some ways it was good, but also because it was bad, but it was excellently bad. Because as someone who grew up in a Christian family, I went to church a lot, and I sang a lot of, I listened to lots of sermons and lots of talks about the Bible and lots of talks about life and about how to live and all that kind of stuff, exactly as you'd imagine. If you imagine someone who goes to church three times a week, which is what I would do, imagine how much of this I listened to, but also how much I did. I actually sang myself. And in our church, I went to a youth fellowship, and for a few years, I played the music and was the band leader, the worship leader, as they call it. So I'd be up there with my guitar or with my keyboard, and would lead worship and lead people in singing. And I sang, and it also wrote as well, quite a lot of Christian music and worship music. And this music that we hear in this thing is kind of perfectly bad. It is bad in all of the ways that I didn't like Christian rock, Christian contemporary music or whatever they did. It's because they're taking a song and they make, this isn't what we don't hear. It's not congregational singing. What we're hearing is kind of like the album version, the solo album version of the congregational singing music. And all of the ways which Christian contemporary music or Christian rock is so clumsy with writing and so clumsy with putting the you know, the words of the Bible to music, or some, you know, clever turn of phrase to music, and then trying to make cool music or trying to make interesting music. But it can't be too offensive, because if it's too out there, oh, it must be of the devil. Or if it's too progressive, the music is too progressive. So there's this thing that I heard someone say once, is that when you're at a church, you always know what kind of music you're going to get, because it's going to be the music that the pastor of the church, the kind of level of rock music, the development of rock music that that was popular when the pastor of the church was around about 20 years old. So in the, you know, when I was around, like all of the musical influences, like the main musical influences that we'd have of the music that we'd listen to was kind of like 70s music, not 90s when I was there, you know, always lagging behind 20 years. And the music that we have here, it doesn't actually say here in the audiobook information in the app what who wrote the music, because it says the words to the songs is by Margaret Atwood, but does it even say it here? No, it doesn't say who does the music. It's not the narrator who is doing the narration. It's actually somebody else who has put together this music. But it is really great. It is kind of perfect Christian contemporary music based on Christians' ideals, and some of them really got stuck. One of them in particular, which is like the second to last song, really got stuck in my head because it is really bad. And I played it for you, Leanna. I was like, listen to this. I've been singing this in my head for the last 3 days after listening to this and finishing this book. And she says, oh, this is terrible. This is really bad. And I was like, no, just keep listening. It gets really good. And by the end of it, she was like, that's now going to be stuck in my head. And then for an hour later, she's like, that music is still stuck in my head. The track, if anyone is wondering, it was called The Longest Mile. It goes, the last mile is the longest, longest mile. The last mile is the longest, longest. And yeah, that can get stuck in your head. So I didn't play it to her from the audiobook. I went over and found it, and it turns out someone's uploaded all of these, or a few different people have uploaded all of these tracks to YouTube. So even if you haven't listened to the audiobook and you're just reading this book, I really do suggest saving the play or looking up the playlist. You'll be able to find it. Just search for, you know, the Year of the Flood music, whatever. You'll find it on YouTube. And when you get to that part of the book, even if you're just reading it as an ebook or as a paper book, just pause and just listen to the music, because it really did add a lot to my enjoyment of this book. And also what's really fun about it, and this is what I was going to mention this, of course, but Jenny also said it in our review in Oryx and Quake. She said, yeah, in the second book of the audiobook, you actually get this music and these, you know, and these sermons and these music. And she said, which is, I was going to say this myself as well, because it's quite fun, is that at the start of the book, things are going pretty well for the God's Gardeners. You know, their numbers are growing, and all of the sermons are like, yes, we're good, God is good, and this is how we should live our lives. And by the end, as things get really, really bad, and more, you know, they're more and more persecuted and under the weather, and then the food is running out, it's sort of like, yes, we praise God for giving us these rats. Because he's given us them to eat, so we should be able to eat these rats. Yes, yes, we need these calories, we need this sustenance. Our garden is being destroyed, so we don't have that anymore. Oh, we're on the run. And as you see the kind of like moral arc of the God's Gardeners and the different people there, especially our main characters as well, it starts off and they're like, oh yes, we do this, we're vegetarians, we eat honey and we look after the bees, and by the end of it they're like, yeah, give me that pork sandwich, that pork, give me now. And all the God's Gardeners who come through to the end of the book, as they go through the book, it's sort of like they're much more like, yes, thank God for surviving the waterless flood, but also give me that burger. Yeah, it's kind of fun that that's reflected in the sermons that are given and the music that is sung, which is really a lot of fun. What else do I have to say about this? I didn't make any notes as I was going through this. Maybe I should have, did I? Let me quickly look up here. Nope, don't have any notes. My last notes that I made were for Nine Fox Gambit, which was quite a few episodes ago. So I don't have any more notes about this. I just want to say that I really enjoyed this book. And in a way, I enjoyed it. Oh, that's my alarm going off. I enjoyed it so much as I was reading it, apart from the slow beginning. But overall, I was enjoying most of it so much that I kind of forgot what I didn't like about the first book. And I was like, as soon as I finished it, I was like, well, of course, I'm going to just go straight on to the next book. Well, I say straight on. I already have the next book in the trilogy, the Mad Adam, you know, already on my phone, ready to go. So, yeah, that I did have some issues with this, but I really enjoyed this. And I think I much more prefer this book because I really didn't like Jimmy, which brings me to one of the complaints that I had about the first book is that I didn't like Jimmy so much. And then we were kind of, it was called Oryx and Quake, but we're only getting Oryx and Quake's story via Jimmy. And we were really only getting, Oryx's story through Crake and then through Jimmy, and it was kind of more clear that's this is what Jenny said as well on the first on that first podcast that we did. She says, what I liked about it is that you end the book with more questions than you would have thought at the beginning, and this book answers a lot of those questions, but not in a way that I often don't like about sequels. Because often with sequels, I quite like there's a mystery at the end of the book, and it's like, oh, well, how does it turn out? We don't know. And then the sequel is just like, oh, and then this happened, and this explained, and then this explains that, and then this explains this, and this character comes in and tells us what happened in the first book in that way. Or that is often very, very unsatisfying, and it takes away the mystery, and often the mystery is what I like. What I liked about this book is that it filled in quite a lot more of the background, but it didn't do it via characters. Of course, we're still not entirely sure what Crake was up to and what the Mad Adams were doing and what the God's Gardeners were, but it fills in a lot more of the details from that first book in a way which is actually more enjoyable, and it is more fun, and also brings up more questions, which apparently this third book in this trilogy gets more into some more details and explains more about that too, which again, I don't really know who we're going to be following, but it seems to be, I mean, if the book is called Mad Adam, it's probably going to be the Mad Adam character in this book and the Mad Adams as we get at the end of the last book. There's a group that call themselves the Mad Adams, so I'm sure we'll be following their story of what they were doing during the Waterless Flood, leading up to and doing during the Waterless Flood, and what Morv Craik was doing, because there seems to be a connection there. So, what was I going to say? Yeah, what I liked about this is that it didn't feel like there was somebody else's story who was the main story going on, and I wasn't reading their story, I was reading a side story. I think because the expectations of that first book really set it up, is like, yeah, we're not, this isn't going to be Craig's story. It's going to be these other characters and what happened to them, because I kind of knew that going in and kind of expected it. But also it didn't feel like I was missing out on anything, because the main characters are having a good enough story by themselves that I felt like I was getting their story and I was reading their story as them. I was, you know, Ren was having these adventures and she was doing this, and I was reading about Ren doing that. And Toby was, there's stuff happening with Toby and she was doing this, and I was reading about what was happening with Toby from Toby's point of view. The two different books, one of them was told in first person, they're both in second person, but one was told in present tense and one was told in past tense. But, you know, otherwise we were just following along with their stories pretty much from the start. You know, there wasn't a lot of flashbacking. I mean, there was a bit, but it wasn't really that. But the good thing is that I felt like I was reading about the story of the people who I was following. Unlike the first book, where I felt like I was reading the most important story here, or the story that we were trying to find out was Craig's story, but I was only reading it through Jimmy's point of view. And it was much more satisfying being a bit more immediately involved with the story and immediately involved in these characters' lives, because I liked Toby. I mostly liked Ren. There's other characters that I quite enjoyed spending time with. There's these characters who were come in. I was like, yes, I'm glad that these characters are back. When we read about Adam, Adam number one, and what happens to him, and does he make it, or what's going to happen with him? I was like, oh, I really hope he makes it. And I don't think there was anyone in that first book where I was like, oh yeah, I really hope this character makes it through to the end, and I really hope something good happens to this character. Although, of course, in that book, we know that only Jimmy survives. So we know that everybody else is going to die and not going to make it. But in this book, because we know that these characters do survive, it's sort of like, well, this character survives, and I hope that other character survives, and I hope this character, I hope these characters come back and we have some different bits of experience with that. I just generally liked the characters in this book a whole lot more. And that can go a long way with me just enjoying the reading experience of spending time with the God's Gardeners and spending time with even when they leave the God's Gardeners, I kind of just enjoy what they do outside of the gardens and what adventures that they have later on in the book. And I never really enjoyed spending time with the characters in the first book, like I said before, because they were just so, like, just not nice people. And I can kind of see the challenge there as a writer to do that kind of thing. And I appreciate all of the writing. It's just the decisions that were made in that first book, I just didn't enjoy spending time with that book. Whereas in this book, I mostly enjoyed spending time with it, even though I do think there was a bit of depravity porn at the start, where it's kind of like, I say, it's like almost too depraved to be believable. Of course, it's more believable in the Plebelands than it was in the corporation compounds. I'm not really sure what else I have to say about this book. I'm on a cruise at the moment, so I don't have any internet at the moment to look up what other people think on Goodreads, but I'm going to give this book I'd say 4.5 stars, and that's a big step up from the first book. And in my head, my memory of the first book was a 4-star book, so I do suggest, if you've read the first book and you're not sure, oh, shall I continue or not, definitely continue the second book. It's kind of interesting that this is, I wouldn't say a better book, but I would say it's a more enjoyable book than the first book, and it has less of the things I didn't like about the first book and more of the things that I did like about the first book. So on balance, I enjoyed this one a lot more. One of the other complaints that I had about the first book was that, like, the different levels of technology, where they live in a world where gene sequencing is so easy that they can create whole new different species of animals and different species of humans from scratch almost so quickly and so easily. And there's, you know, vacuum tube bullet trains, there's hyperloops going around across America, and yet people have some other technologies, like, oh yeah, and this stuff is on DVDs. Now, that was a bit weird, because everyone in that first book, like I say, most of the stories happen in these corporate compounds where this technology is generally very high. And I was like, there's different mismatches of technology don't really sit well with me. It seems like, you know, not very well thought out world building. In this book, that different mismatch of technologies actually worked really well, or a lot better, even though I complained about it not being good world building and not being good writing in the first, at least science fiction writing in that first book review that I did. Whereas in this one, it makes a bit more sense, because when you're out in the world and you're out in the plebe lands and you're in places where people don't have as much money and there isn't as much technology, there are many more different mismatches of technology, which is, you know, it's kind of to be expected. And I've noticed this when I've been traveling around, you know, in different places, especially when I was down in, I remember once going to, Tanzania and Dar es Salaam, and I think this was like in 2009, and while I was out there, it was kind of weird that like some of the technology with the internet and mobile phone stuff seemed to be very high, but then like so much of the other technology, like transport technology, was very, very low. No, it wasn't Dar es Salaam, it was another village, but you know, so people had mobile phones and technology which you generally consider quite high, but then also they had Sega Mega Drives, like these cart computer games and stuff, just in this, you know, in this cafe. And I was like, oh, this is actually weird. So when I was complaining about the mixture of DVDs and high technology, I definitely do see, it's probably a bad example, but I've seen different examples of this around the world where people have super high technology and yet super low technology, or different mismatched technology, some stuff which is from the 80s and some stuff which is from, you know, 30 year gaps in technology, and it's all being used side by side. It kind of makes a bit more sense. Oh, there's, what's that? I have to go to a lifeboat drill. So let's get this wrapped up. If you agreed with this review, you can email me, and or if you disagree, any comments about this, you can email me luke@juggler.net. you can follow me on Twitter and send me comments there. I'm at Luke Burridge on Twitter. Also on Instagram, I'm at Luke Burridge on Instagram. And also on YouTube, if you're interested in my vlogging project that I'm doing at the moment, where I'm doing lots of stuff about juggling and traveling and being a professional juggler, vlogging about that, you can find me on YouTube too. I'm Luke Burridge on YouTube. And check out the website, sfbrp.com, and you can find all of the books that I've ever reviewed on the podcast, and all the other special episodes, and some of these episodes that I've done on other podcasts, like this, the previous book, Oryx and Crake. I reviewed that on the SFF audio podcast, so you can find that listed right there on the sfbrp.com. Because the RSS feeds don't go back more than 150 episodes, so if you're wondering about other books, the best way to do it is just go on there, and you can huff-duff the episodes. Huff-duffer is what you need if you want to get these episodes which aren't on the feed. But I will be working on this work trip. I'll be working on a way of making an archive feed, having the first 300 episodes all in a certain feed, which is kind of a static archive feed for people to get hold of there. So yeah, that's it. Oh yeah, let me do the Audible plug. This is what I do. I like to say, I do suggest if you're gonna read this book, I do suggest listening to the audiobook. It is really great. So go to audibletrial.com/sfbrp, and if you use that link, use the SFBRP code, you can get this book for free by signing up for a plan. You get a month of the plan free. I have a platinum plan. There's also a gold plan. A platinum plan gives you 2 books per month, and that's what I do because I get through a lot of these books. The normal plan gets you 1 book per month, and it is way, 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 way cheaper to listen to audiobooks with a subscription than it is to buy audiobooks individually. Because when you're buying them individually, they could be $20, $30, $40, $50 per audiobook, depending on the length and the size and things. It's much, much easier and cheaper and less stressful to just get the credits, because sometimes you'll get a big book and you'll be like, wow, I got a real deal there on that book, because I only paid however much it is per month, $20 per month for the platinum plan for like 2 books per month, or I think it's like $12 per month for 1 audiobook. You think, wow, I got a steal. That's like a 60-hour audiobook, and I only paid this amount. And then some other times when, like, you'll see a book which is, you know, cheaper otherwise, or, you know, is only $10, and you're like, oh, well, I should be spending my... It doesn't matter. Just remove the thoughts about how much audiobooks costs, because you're always going to make have a much better deal with Audible if you sign up for a plan. And you can test out that plan for free if you go to audibletrial.com/SFBIP, and in doing so, you show your support and help out the podcast with my own with my own book buying and book reading and the bandwidth cost for hosting the SFBIP and the development that I do on the website and all that kind of different stuff. You help support that, so I'd appreciate it if you go check it out. And yeah, you can get all three of these books right there on Audible. And yeah, I've already got the next book. The book that I'm reading at the moment, though, is actually another second book in the series. It's called The Night Without Stars. Let me actually quickly look here on Audible. Oh, why does my Audible app has to relaunch every time? A Night Without Stars, a novel of the something Commonwealth, I guess, by Peter F. Hamilton, narrated by John Lee. It's so nice to go back to a John Lee book, and it's like, ah, John Lee, a very easy audio book narrator to listen to. I really enjoy that. I've also got Poseidon's Wake, another second book in a series. This one by Alistair Reynolds. And what else do I have? Oh yeah, and Mad Adam, the last book in this series. So over the next few books that I do, it's going to be second and third books in some series. Oh, I've got Memories of Ice here as well by Stephen Erickson, which is another third book in a series, which I actually started listening to a while ago, and I need to get on with that. And I have All the Birds in the Sky as an ebook, which I'll be reading. Juliana gave that one, I think on Goodreads, she says it's only the fourth book she's ever given one stars to. So I'll be saving that podcast until I get home in two and a half weeks' time, and Juliana will be joining me to talk about one of the most recommended books of last year, All the Birds in the Sky. I don't have that in front of me. Oh, actually, I do. Let me quickly look here. There's Kindle. All the Birds in the... This is so you can also read along and see what I really enjoyed about this book, because I'm quite enjoying it so far, compared to what Juliana doesn't like about this. I don't have... Library. All the Birds in the Sky by Charlie Jane Anders, who I've never read before, but we'll see how Charlie Jane Anders holds up with All the Birds in the Sky, me going into it knowing that Juliana gave it one star. So that's it from me. Thanks a lot for listening, and I'll catch you next time.